Lately, I've been getting both enjoyment and nurture from a collection of writings by the Reverend David Rankin. It's called Dancing in the Empty Spaces. They are short meditations, many of them drawn from his years, many years in Unitarian Universalist ministry, from which he now reflects upon his retirement. I found one that I thought would be particularly appropriate to lead off with this morning. In 1968, I delivered a sermon prior to the presidential election. It was not a partisan plea, since I was not overly impressed with either Richard Nixon or Hubert Humphrey. Instead, I merely recommended at the conclusion of the sermon that I hoped everyone would vote for the most intelligent, experienced, and compassionate candidate. So imagine my surprise when a man confronted me in the reception line and angrily shouted, "How dare you use the pulpit to support Hubert Humphrey?" Dave Rankin's mini memoir is only one of numerous examples that those of us in the ministry learn pretty early on in our careers, which is that while you can control the words that come out of your mouth when you are speaking from the pulpit, you have very little, if any, control over how those same words are heard when they reach the ears of your listeners. I also take from Reverend Rankin's anecdote yet another lesson in the perils of the pre-election sermon, and yet we ministers still go on doing them. I can't assume that every single one of my colleagues in the UU Parish Ministry is delivering a sermon today on the upcoming presidential election this Tuesday. I do know that those who are not are few and far between. And maybe they're among the smarter ones of us. Who knows? After all, I don't know of anything I could say this morning that I have not, in one way or another, addressed already in recent months and years. And those of you who have been hearing my words from here and other conversations for any reasonable length of time are quite familiar, I am sure, with my political, social, and cultural leanings. I'm guessing as well that at this point there are very few, if any, undecided voters sitting in front of me. Knowing all that, what I want to do the next several minutes is to share with you some of the personal thoughts that I will be taking to my voting place on Tuesday. One of the more ironic things I'm finding as I do a little internal inventory right now with respect to who we as a nation elect to the presidency is, I find that it is not about me at all, while at the same time intensely personal. Here's what I mean. When I think about the general direction I see my life taking over the next 4 to 5 years, while granting, of course, that no one can completely predict his or her personal future, I don't see any significant difference in that direction because of who is president of the United States. I'll get older. I'll attend to the things I need to attend to when it comes to my life in the ministry and family life, in pursuing some of my more personal interests and hobbies and avocations. I know that I will enjoy my life at times and quite likely get upset or frustrated with it at other times. Like most of us here, I would guess I have a certain floor of security that I can walk on, build my life around. And when I look at some of the precarious conditions that many persons live with on a daily basis, conditions having to do with their economic well-being or their health or with painful family matters or just with a host of other things, I become aware of how remiss I often am when it comes to being truly thankful the station in life that I occupy and enjoy, for those hidden blessings that were referred to in our words for reflection a little earlier. Compared with the lot of most of the human beings with whom I share life on this planet, I live a life of privilege. And this presidential election will not in any way I can see or foresee significantly alter that fact. And that's the part that's not about me. Here's the part that is. I'm a citizen of a country called the United States of America. I have been for close to 6 decades now. My citizenship is a fundamental element of my identity, just as my race and my gender, my sexual orientation, my family of origin, my immediate family, the career I've chosen, and the interests I pursue are also all fundamental parts of my identity. The things that happen, many of the things that happen within this nation and the things that are done in its name are a part of me. They're a part of who I am. They're about me. I will think on these things in a number of ways as I cast a vote for president in a couple of days. So I want to share with you some of those number of ways or number of things that I will be thinking about. I've got 6 of them. I'm thinking about the cohesiveness. What Bill Sinkford spoke to a little earlier, we heard from Gary. I'm thinking about the cohesiveness or lack of cohesiveness that exists in this country at present. I have lived through, beginning from my college days, the civil rights era, through the issues of black or African-American empowerment, through the Vietnam War, through the Watergate and Nixon resignation era. I do recall how each and all of these events had a polarizing effect upon our country that took its toll upon our national psyche. But having been there during all of them and having paid very close attention to and having been involved myself in some of them, I cannot recall a greater level of divisiveness among our populace than we are experiencing right now. I know that the vigorous and sometimes even rowdy competition of ideas and principles and values is the stuff of democracy itself. But there are times when that process seems to turn in on itself, becomes destructive. I've had my goodly share of arguments over the past months and years with the columnist and commentator Tom Friedman. But I think he was pretty well on the mark in a piece he had the New York Times op-ed page this past Thursday. He wrote, "American politics is so polarized today that there is no center, only sides. When you read polls showing a significant number of Americans feel our country is on the wrong track, what do you think is bothering people? I think it is a deep worry that there is a hole in the heart of the world. No center, only sides. A hole in our collective heart." I think Friedman is close to the mark here. I will be voting for the presidential candidate whom I feel is best equipped and positioned to attend to this lack of a center, to this hole in our national and global heart. This is the first consideration. I suggest you take the polls on Tuesday, whichever way you cast your vote. I'm a citizen of the wealthiest and most powerful nation in the world. The fact that the phrase wealthiest and most powerful nation in the world is a cliche doesn't make it any less factual. I'm at the point now where I neither bemoan over nor exalt about that fact. I simply accept it. It is. I will vote for the presidential candidate whom I feel is best equipped and positioned to deal with that reality with creativity and with a healthy sense of a global common good. I will vote for the candidate whom I feel best understands and appreciates the fact that being the most powerful nation in the world does not mean that we can simply have our way with the world. I want to make another go at Friedman's column on this issue as well, primarily because Mr. Friedman supported the American invasion of Iraq. He has, in large measure, been a supporter of the president in his response to the 9/11 attacks vis-a-vis the rest of the world. If these were Michael Moore's words, I would not be quoting them because he would be one more of the usual suspects. This, however, is Tom Friedman, quote, "The Bush team has made itself so radioactive it glows in the dark. When the world liked Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan, America had more power in the world. Now America has less power. People do not want to be seen standing next to us. This doesn't mean we should run our foreign policy as a popularity contest, but it does mean that leading is not about just making decisions. It is about the ability to communicate, follow through, and persuade. I will vote for the presidential candidate whom I feel is best equipped to, at least some positive degree, rectify the situation that I believe Friedman accurately describes. I would like a president who will make this country more powerful because of the ways in which the nations of the world trust and respect us and cease seeing us as more of a threat than a promise. This is the second consideration I will be taking to the polls on Tuesday. I suggest you take it as well, regardless of how you cast your ballot. I'm going to quickly add one thing here before leaving this point, and that is that there are numerous instances in our country's history where presidents have learned from their mistakes, and when their leadership has been changed and enhanced on the basis and strength of that learning, such things are truly possible. Lyndon Johnson's repudiation of his segregationist ways and his championing of the 1964 Civil Rights Act is one example of this. Of course, in order to learn and grow from one's mistakes, one first has to acknowledge that a mistake has been made. Moving on. Last Sunday, I spoke to the issue of fear and the extent to which it now drives our civic and global policies and behavior. I'm not going to bring all that back this morning. I spoke to it last week, and you can look at the sermon. It's on our webpage. I'm only going to add this today. I will vote for the presidential candidate whom I feel is best equipped and positioned to furnish us with the protection we do in fact need in order to have a secure civic life and to remain secure and safe in the larger world while not needlessly or cynically playing on our fears in that world. Constitutionally speaking, one of the few stated things we require in the presidential oath of office is the chief executive preserve, protect, and defend our country and its constitution. I will vote for the presidential candidate whom I feel is best equipped and positioned to truly preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States without using fear as a means of manipulating that very same Constitution. This is the fourth consideration I will take to the polls on Tuesday. However you cast your ballots, I ask you to take that one too. To get to my next consideration. I'm going to ask your indulgence for a few minutes so I can bring in some of my personal story here, parts of which I know I've spoken to in other sermons. I'm concerned about the ever-increasing disparity, the ever-increasing gap between those who have the economic means to participate in what we still like to call the American dream and those who do not. Here's a personal angle. As many of you know from things I've shared previously, I grew up in one of the poorer regions of this country in an often struggling working class family. My father, whose formal education, went to the eighth grade, was a self-employed house painter who had to hustle for every job he got. He did not draw a company paycheck every 2 weeks. He worked as hard to make a living as anyone I think I have ever witnessed in my lifetime. Until I was in high school, which was when my three younger sisters had also gotten to be of school age, my mother stayed at home and took care of us, which means she certainly worked, but she didn't earn any money for it. That floor of security, which I referred earlier, was not near as stable for us then as it is now for me and for my family. And yet, for all of those challenges and difficulties, we owned our own house. From the time I was 10 years old, my sisters and I were well fed and well clothed, and we were kept in good health with the help of our family doctor in the local hospital. There were no frills, nothing fancy, no paid vacations for my father or anything like that. but we live well enough, or at least we live free from want for the very essentials of life. My sisters and I all went to college. We all earned master's degrees even. That kind of life, hard as one had to work to gain it, was still possible and still available to those on even some of the lower rungs of the national economic chain during my childhood and adolescence and even early adulthood. I'm not at all sure, however, that such is still the case today. Even if you were to translate my father's earnings into today's dollars, I seriously doubt you could, solely on those dollars, raise a family that included four kids, own a house, provide for their food, clothing, health, and at least in part their education, in the manner that my parents were able to do so. I'm not an economist. I don't play one on TV, and I don't try to play one from this pulpit either, and I don't believe that the whole situation I've just described here can be reduced to one factor. With all those caveats, I believe, though, that the increasing concentration of ever-increasing amounts of wealth in the hands of a smaller number of people is at least one significant factor in relegating many of our working-class citizens into a permanent underclass. If you want to read one book that well demonstrates and documents this fact, I would recommend this one. It was published a few years ago. It's called Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America. It's by Barbara Ehrenreich. It is a wonderful piece of writing. I can't launch forth into a whole sermon on it, but what she did, she worked, she took jobs, she worked about 40 different parts of the country, gave herself like about $100 worth of kind of startup money to get herself settled in, took whatever jobs that would be available to someone with about a high school education, which were mostly minimum wage jobs, and then tried to see, just supporting herself, nobody else, and then tried to see if she could live on the money she was making in her four different parts of the country. She found there was no way that she could do it. Both of our two major presidential candidates were born into and raised as children of wealth and high privilege. It is the only life that either one of them have known. I do not expect either one of them to personally identify with the people Ms. Ehrenreich so poignantly describes in her book, or even the people like me who carry the memories that I do of my own growing up times. Neither one of them are in a position to do that. Neither do I expect either candidate to fully identify the situation I've just described, not in a four-year period anyway. But I will vote for the presidential candidate whom I feel is best positioned, equipped, and personally committed to at least not exacerbating further the inordinate concentration of wealth in this nation, and who will seek ways to restore the promise of a viable and economically secure and healthy life for those who really do strive for it, knowing that many of those who are now doing such striving are still not making it. This is the fifth consideration I will be taking to the polls this Tuesday. However you cast your vote, it's another consideration I urge you to take as well. Finally, I do want a president who is guided by faith in and faithfulness to some higher concept of the common good for both our nation and the world. If his concept of that common good is shaped and informed by his religious beliefs and convictions, then I believe that is all to the good. Just a few quick points along this area before I close. Framers of our Constitution specifically stated that no religious test shall be required to hold public office. And they weren't looking to just rhetorically fill up space when they put that line in the Constitution. The letter of this constitutional law, to be sure, has always been upheld in that no candidate for the office of president or any other public office has ever been required to attest to a particular religious belief as a condition of being on the ballot or holding office. The spirit of this well-conceived law, however, has been taking something of a beating lately. While the president himself has never made such a claim, not in any kind of a public arena, that is, there are those among his more visible and vocal supporters who have avowed that he is the true Christian in this race, the one who is especially attuned to the mind of God and that he knows what is best for this country because he is a man of faith. I don't question the man of faith part. On the other hand, because of some of his stands on certain social issues, Senator Kerry has sometimes been characterized as a phony Catholic and one for whom true Catholics should not be supporting. Above and beyond all this is the larger reality that anyone running for high public office and who does not accept or relate to the idea of a supreme being would be, as any number of surveys indicate, regarded as unfit to hold office on that basis alone. So while we legally do not require a religious test to hold public office, on the social and cultural level, we most certainly do. And that reality has not gone unnoticed by the operatives of this presidential campaign in any number of ways. Just point to one. The fact, for example, that the president has been willing to exploit the issue of same-sex marriage for whatever political mileage he can extract from it, while Senator Kerry is afraid to even go near it, does demonstrate, to my way of thinking, at least one way in which the religious test for public office remains in effect. Be all that as it may, I will vote for the presidential candidate, whom I feel is best equipped in position to use his religious beliefs, values, and convictions as a unifying factor in our common life. I want a president who sees his personal religious stance as one expression of those larger and universal religious truths that affirm our common humanity, that bespeak universal brother and sisterhood, that bless the peacemakers, that call for justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, and that encompass a vision of the common good for the upbuilding and preservation of life itself on this earth which we all share. Not that I want a whole lot, but because I will add that nobody, myself clearly included, the presidential candidates certainly included as well, nobody bats a thousand when it comes up to living out the best in their religion. But this is the sixth consideration I will have in mind as I cast my vote for president. However you cast your ballot, it's one I urge you to take as well. Well, these are plenty enough considerations for one morning and one presidential election. 11 persons, I counted them up the other night, 11 persons have held the office of president during my lifetime. This will be the 10th presidential election in which I have cast a ballot. I've cast all those ballots because this country is important to me, and who leads it and who represents it in the larger world is also important to me. I trust the same is the case with you. I love this land, from California to the New York Island to Nashua, New Hampshire. I do not always love or value or appreciate everything that's done in the name of this land, or some of the ways in which we are sometimes led in this land. But I continue to believe that this land called America is a good place, with, by and large, good people. In this election, I look for a leader and for leaders who will hold up that kind of goodness. I want to go on being a citizen of a country where I still can, in the words of Alfred Lord Tennyson, dip into the future, far as human eye can see, and see the beauty of the world and all the wonder that shall be. Those words are contained in our closing hymn, which is number 143. You've got the wrong number in the order of service. Number 143. Let's sing that together.